It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, federal programs expanded access to free school lunches during the pandemic that may come to an end soon. As Congress didn't extend the funding, we'll find out what's at stake. First, the average cost of gas in Wisconsin hit yet another record high yesterday, up to $4.81 a gallon. Oil cost nearly double the amount it did this time last year. There are a lot of things pushing gas prices up. Supply hasn't matched up with demand. People are driving more than they were, of course, during the height of the pandemic. And the war in Ukraine means that millions of barrels of Russian oil have been largely pulled from the supply chain. All this has put pressure on President Biden, who later this month will travel to Saudi Arabia to meet with leaders about oil production capacity in his latest attempt to bring gas prices down. But how much control does Biden have here? What would it take for prices to go down? Our guest today will give us his insight on where he sees the oil market headed this summer and beyond. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. How are higher gas prices affecting you? Have you cut back on driving if you've been able to? How would you like to see the government tackle the problem? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You could also email ideas@wpr.org. Abhi Rajendran is an energy market researcher with Energy Intelligence. He's also an adjunct research scholar at Columbia University's Center on Global Energy Policy. Abhi, welcome to Central Time.
Ryan, thanks for having me.
Let's take a look kind of step by step here. Before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, gas prices had already gone up some, not to their current levels. What was driving price increases at that point, pre-Ukraine invasion?
Yeah, no, I mean, this is, this is kind of a steady rise that we've seen for a while. I think, all through, last year, as you noted, we saw kind of a steady rise of the average retail price from the twos, kind of the mid twos to start last year. And we ended last year, kind of comfortably above three. And we were kind of creeping towards the mid threes kind of pre-war. And then, of course, everything had changed, has changed in the last couple of months. We were already starting to see the effects of tightening oil and product markets, even pre-war. We had in oil markets, we had inventories, starting to, kind of get into some dangerous waters in terms of low levels. And similarly, gasoline and diesel too, were also kind of headed in that direction. So that was all, kind of contributing to prices pushing higher. And then of course the invasion of the Ukraine by Russia, has kind of changed everything, put all of those trends into overdrive.
I want to run a few narratives that I've heard out there past you and see, help us untangle them. One was pandemic hit. Demand went way down. Prices of one benchmark went down, I think, below zero at one point. Production spun down some because of that. But then as demand came back up, the supply, for whatever reason, people didn't start gearing up production to match that. Is that part of what's happening? And if so, why?
Now, that's certainly part of what's happening, and I think there's two parts to that. There's an oil market part to it where, we've had, U.S. oil production reach close to 13 million barrels a day in late 2019, early 2020, right before the pandemic hit. And as you noted, we had this kind of shock in the spring of 2020 in terms of demand, in terms of consumption, and of course, the lockdowns and everything that happened around the world. And since then, demand has, by and large come back. I think you could argue that, jet fuel is not quite normalized yet. But gasoline, diesel have by and large come back. But U.S. oil supply is still quite a bit below, right? We're still, just around, kind of 11.6 million barrels a day of U.S. oil production. So still quite a bit below that 13 million barrel a day threshold. And it is rising, but it's rising, kind of in a gradual way, recovering post-pandemic. And we can certainly touch on why. I think the second factor is on, further downstream from oil. It's on the refining side. The U.S. market has closed 1 to 1.5 million barrels a day of refining capacity, closed and or announced conversions to biofuels and other products. That's just in the U.S. and that's also been a global trend. We've lost 3 to 3.5 million barrels a day of global refining capacity. And this is partly why, you're kind of in the dynamic that you are now with kind of shortages and these price spikes happening for products, for diesel, for gasoline, and kind of pulling oil along with it. Because we have all this capacity that was lost over the last couple of years. Demand has largely come back. When you threw the kind of the Russia invasion into the mix, it's really sort of sent the market into a spiral and a little bit of a panic. So I think demand is back, supply is not, for both oil and for refining capacity. I think both of them are contributing to this environment.
We are talking about gas prices, why they are where they are. Abhi Rajendran is with us from Energy Intelligence. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts, maybe your experiences. What do higher gas prices mean for you? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jack is with us in Viola. Jack, hello.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thank you for the show. All the explanations that your guest gave doesn't justify the record profit-taking that is going on with oil companies. All of it doesn't make any sense because you can buy gas wherever you go. There's supply everywhere, okay? Nobody's going to a gas station and say, oh, we're out of gas. No. And we know that under former President Trump, they cut oil production in Saudi Arabia. That's why Biden's going over there. But the point is, you got record profits by companies that we are always, supporting with our tax money. And these guys are taking us to the cleaners.
Jack, thanks for the call. Abhi, we're seeing quarterly reports out from a bunch of different oil companies showing big numbers in profits, in some cases record profits. How big is Jack's question as part of the story here?
Yeah, no, it's definitely an interesting and a relevant point from Jack that and to your point, most companies in the energy space, whether they're producing oil or gas or refiners, are generating record profits. In many cases, the highest quarters that they've delivered earnings results in their history, over the last couple of quarters. I think in a normal cycle, these type of profit levels and all the cash flow that they generate from these profits would translate to these companies, reinvesting that capital, right? They would be, taking that capital and, putting it back in the case of oil companies or gas companies, at the drill head to increase production, increase rig counts rapidly, and kind of get the supply side going again. On the refining side, they would be, especially with these type of profits, they would be looking to see where they can add refining capacity, whether it's in kind of expanded capacity of existing facilities or potentially even looking to build new facilities. I think what's different this time is this whole conversation around the energy transition, kind of a focus on climate. And concerns about having to cut emissions, looking out over the next couple of decades, this has also kind of entered into the budgeting and capital allocation conversation with companies, and I think that's part of the reason why they are not sort of being allowed to reinvest at the rates at which they would have in the past, and this kind of goes back to investors, right? I think investors have mandated this capital discipline on companies, have asked them to sort of be more restrained with spending and expenditures, and have shown a preference for if these companies are generating high levels of profits and cash flows, for them to simply, increase their dividends or their buybacks and return it back to the shareholders, as opposed to reinvest it. So I think that's what's different this time. I would say, the companies are, being told not to reinvest by investors. They are, their whole you know, kind of management compensation models have changed over the last couple of years to prioritize, you know, returning cash flows and not, you know, reinvesting and growing. And then that's part of the reason why we continue to have this hole on the supply side for both oil and for products. You know, and I would just say that, you know, the price of, you know, any, you know, kind of energy market, and in for our discussion, it's oil, it's gasoline, it's diesel. It's really sort of set by, you know, by international markets, right? It's not set by, you know, these companies, you know, or a group of companies or any one company. It's set by the international markets. And, you know, and you know, the war and the conflict has, you know, tightened international markets, especially in Europe, especially for diesel. And that's kind of spilled over into gasoline now. And you know, the U.S. can't really sort of insulate itself from these global market dynamics. And, you know, refiners are generating record profits and they are incentivized to run as hard as they can. And in the U.S., they are. You know, U.S. refiners are really, you know, sort of running pretty much as hard as they can. And we're only into the start of the summer. You know, we're not even, you know, into kind of peak driving season yet. And so they're kind of running as hard as they can. And there's not really that much harder that they can go. You know, as they run hard, they will continue to buy more and more oil, right? So even though oil has gone from kind of 70, 80 up to, you know, 110, 120 now, they'll continue to buy that because
we're talking to energy market researcher Abhi Rajendran about gas prices and the many factors that influence the number you see on the pump. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. How is the high cost of fuel influencing your life, your personal part of the economy? Are there things you would like to see the federal government, for example, doing to try to bring prices down? Call 800-642-1234. Have you changed driving habits, if you're able, cutting back on optional road trips, for example, carpooling? I don't know. You tell us. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation about oil and gas prices with Abhi Rajendran, energy market researcher with the group Energy Intelligence. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your possible solutions, and what the price of gas means to you these days. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Tom is with us in Menominee Falls. Hi, Tom.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to ask your guest, if we were just to flat out get rid of all taxes that the U.S. government takes, both state and federal, if there is a difference, how much of a difference would it affect at the pump per gallon? I mean, we send tens of millions or tens of billions of dollars to, you know, fight other wars. Can't we make some tax cuts here to help us low-income people out?
Thanks for the call. Abhi, how much do state and federal taxes play into what we see when we're at the gas pump?
No, it's a great question from Tom. You know, we've seen this over the last couple of months. You know, various states like Maryland, Georgia, Connecticut, you know, New York, for example, you know, start to cut these gas taxes, right? You know, it is certainly a tool to kind of help ease the burden on the consumer. You know, I think part of the challenge at this point is, you know, while that is a tool that's being used, the market continues to tighten. And so some of these tax cuts are just kind of being run over and offset by a market that, you know, just continues to, you know, get shorter on these products and continue to drift higher, over the next couple of months. And I think the other part of it is that, you know, yes, gas tax relief helps, to take a little bit off the price. The knock-on effect to that is that it continues to encourage demand, right? So demand remains relatively firm. You know, the supply side continues to remain restrained, and so prices keep going up. So it is a tool. It is certainly a tool, and we've seen it used certainly at the state level. And of course, taxes are part of the gas price. You know, the problem is, I think the market dynamics continue to point to higher prices. You know, right now, you know, we're just shy of $5. You know, for kind of a national average for a retail price. You know, I see this kind of getting to the mid fives. as driving season really kicks in over the next couple of months. So so that's kind of the you know the push and the torque you know behind the market is you know continues to you know point to higher prices, unfortunately.
Let's bring out another caller now. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hello.
Hi. I'm wondering if the world situation stays the same for the rest of the year, what will be the situation in the coming winter when energy demands increase for heating?
Interesting question. We're bringing natural gas into the picture as well. Abhi, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's an important one from Tom, and I certainly cover you know the gas side of it as well. And you know, for all the talk of gasoline and oil, you know, we're only just now starting to talk about the fact that U.S. natural gas prices have gone from sort of $3-4 now to $9-10. So you know, made a pretty significant change. And it's a similar story on the gas side too. It's constrained supply, pretty strong demand, and of course. Strong demand in Europe and in Asia, for our exports, and as Europe in particular tries to wean off Russian gas, points to a tighter market for a while here in the U.S. as well. I think this is it's an important question. We are already at $9-10, and it's just the start of the summer. I think there's certainly risk that the winter could see some very tight pricing generally, but certainly in some of those key areas, right? Like up in the Northeast, in California, parts of the Midwest could see, kind of Europe style pricing, $20-30 potentially. So it's going to be pretty challenging, certainly for folks trying to, heat their homes and stay warm in the winter, but also for businesses, industrial commercial demand, will face the effects of higher prices both this summer and potentially even higher prices as we get into the winter. So that is also kind of part of the energy challenge as we look out to the second half of the year.
Tom, thanks for that call. I'll be focusing back in on oil and gas, for our cars and whatnot. You've described a market where businesses don't necessarily want to invest to increase capacity, a global market where the United States doesn't necessarily control these things. Are there things that, say, the Biden administration could do to make a difference?
Yeah, I mean, it's an important question with not very easy answers in terms of any kind of low hanging fruit that the administration could look to use, right? In the oil market, you had the SPR, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, that was a tool and an option to, avoid extreme dislocations in supply, and we've been leaning pretty heavily on that and will continue to do so. There is no real similar tool for gasoline markets, right, or diesel markets. I think some of the possible levers are back to the other Tom's question around gas tax relief. These are levels that can be pulled at the at the state level, at the local level, to provide some relief. But again, I think it's basically what you're talking about is trying to limit the upside for prices this summer. There's no real sort of tool that could get prices to stop going up or certainly have prices go down. I think the trend as we get into driving season here still points to prices going up. And it's just a market that you just don't have a whole lot of control over. And the administration has done other things too, right? Like the ethanol waiver relief and some of those areas. So these are all kind of marginally help, potentially preventing, $6+ prices, right? But still, you're looking at a trend that's pointing up over the next couple of months.
And just our last minute and a half or so, I was reading in 2008, prices went up and people drove less. You can't completely get rid of driving. A lot of people have to drive, but demand altered some as a consequence of those higher prices. And that doesn't seem to be happening now. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, it's it's a good question. We expect it to happen. We expect it to happen at the margin, certainly, both for gasoline and for diesel. But again, I think you're also kind of at this point where you're fighting, you know, the seasonal uplift in demand, right? So even if, you know, you do have a little bit of that demand impact at the margin, you're still going to see kind of an upward trend in demand over the next couple of months. And so perhaps you're talking about less growth over the next couple of months, as opposed to, you know, demand actually not growing or falling because of that seasonal effect. And so, and I think this is, you know, this is, again, you know, it's a global market. So it's not just, you know, US driving season, but it's, you know, air conditioning season in the Middle East, it's construction season in other parts of the world. All of these are, you know, kind of providing, kind of this upward thrust for, both gasoline and diesel and oil prices as a knock-on effect, and so that is something that, you know, we expect to see over the next couple of months. But, you know, once you kind of get past the summer, right? I think you know, you referenced 2018. You know, there is a risk that things just kind of get overheated and too high, and that we'll have to see some kind of a correction. And certainly this is something to watch out for, you know, post-summer, right? Once you kind of get past that big bump in demand, demand will fall naturally anyway as you get into the fall. But that high price environment could make that fall sharper this time around, just like it did in 08. Of course, there were other factors in 08, mm-hmm. And there are, you know, kind of more structural supply support factors this time, but, you know, certainly a concern for the second half of the year.
Abhi, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Abhi Rajendran is an energy market researcher with Energy Intelligence, also an adjunct research scholar at Columbia University's Center on Global Energy Policy. He joined us today for a look at the issues contributing to high gas prices. Coming up after the news, we'll hear about the future of free school lunches and what it could mean for families if Congress doesn't continue to offer those programs over the course of the summer, some funding and some waivers set to expire at the end of this month. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we want to hear from you about your favorite hobby. You can get us started right now. Share your hobby story over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, the COVID-19 pandemic prompted Congress and the U.S. Department of Agriculture to offer federal funding and waivers to help provide free school lunches to all students. It looks like that's coming to an end, with the funding and waivers set to expire on June 30th of this year. The waivers aren't extended, school lunches would return to the way they were before the pandemic, among other changes. The end of free lunches to all students would begin this summer and continue through the fall. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a parent or teacher concerned about the end of free school lunches this summer? Is this something that's affected your life, that of your child or your students? Why or why not? Do you think Congress should or shouldn't extend these waivers? What kind of food insecurity have you seen in schools in your local community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Jennifer Gaddis is Associate Professor of Civil Society and Community Studies at UW-Madison. She's the author of The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. Jennifer, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's talk first of all about what these early pandemic era waivers and changes did. What kind of things happened that weren't happening before?
Sure. So when these waivers were first issued in March 2020, there were huge changes impacting schools, including school closures. So these waivers not only allowed schools to start serving school meals for free to all children, regardless of their household income, but also allowed schools to do really innovative things. So for instance, schools used to actually have to serve meals in a cafeteria or other group setting. Some of these waivers actually allowed schools to be able to send meals home to families. And this was especially helpful for a lot of rural communities in particular. Schools were also able to send more than one day's worth of meals at home at any given point in time. And I think a really crucial thing as well is that these waivers really did allow schools to have more money to cover the cost of producing these school meals. So not only is there this issue with the free school meals the ending, but also there's this issue with having less funding and also a lot more restrictions in terms of how meals are going to be served. And a lot of the supply chain challenges that schools have actually faced throughout the pandemic were things that the U.S. Department of Agriculture had congressional authority to be responding to over time. So actually between March 2020, when those first waiver authorities were granted to USDA, and now over 90 waivers and guidance memoranda, which are essentially instruction manuals, have been issued to local school food authorities. So there's been a lot of flexibilities because this is such an evolving circumstance, but basically all of these things are set to end on June 30th, and schools, even though they're not necessarily functioning like normal, and there are a lot of issues impacting students and households in terms of food insecurity that aren't, you know, going to immediately vanish on June 30th, all of these sort of additional federal supports are going to unfortunately end on that date.
One of the cases for letting this thing lapse is this all started when kids were, in many cases, learning from home. They weren't converging on the schools, so you couldn't really get them meals in cafeterias. The early supply chain issues also part of that. Are things back to normal enough where there's a case to be made that we could go back to pre-pandemic settings for our school lunch programs?
Definitely not. There have been some major surveys by not only the School Nutrition Association, which is the major trade organization that represents school nutrition professionals, but also by organizations like FRAC, which is a major nonprofit that works on a wide variety of anti-hunger issues, that really show that school nutrition directors and programs are facing tremendous challenges. So, for example, I know in some of our larger school districts here, even in the state of Wisconsin, there have been huge labor shortages, somewhere around 30% of employees. So not only are you having these issues with labor shortages, but also a lot of the kinds of supply chain challenges that impact other industries, like being able to get in like new kitchen equipment if an oven breaks down, or even just being able to afford the rising cost of food, are all things that really impact school nutrition programs and really impact their bottom lines. Like, these are not programs that really have a lot of excess cash. You know, oftentimes they're very cash strapped, in particular in districts that have school lunch debt that they have to deal with. So it's one of those things where I think not only are the supply chain challenges going to continue, but also some additional challenges that they weren't facing during the pandemic because of these waivers are going to just really slam school districts in the fall in particular. And there's also some major issues I think that we're going to see already this summer just with the summer meal programs as well.
Talking to Jennifer Gaddis from UW-Madison, author of the book, The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools, looking at some big changes as some waivers and funding passed by Congress early in the pandemic set to expire at the end of June could lead to a lot of big changes in who gets food, how food is provided to students during the summer and during the school year. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you have thoughts on this, questions, or maybe a personal experience to share as a student, a parent, or a teacher, or a school lunch provider yourself, love to hear from you. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Jennifer, traditionally, I think we think of a lot of free school lunch programs as being need-based to people who need help affording the food. Why did we have this change during these waivers to allow anybody to access this?
Yeah, I think that one issue was that it was just a lot simpler in many ways, particularly with the need to be able to deliver meals in these innovative ways, since you wouldn't be having individual students enter in their student identification number that would link them to whether their household qualifies for free, reduced price, or full price meals. So partly it was an issue of logistics, but partly I think it was also really this attempt to recognize that there are a lot of families, millions of families across the country, and you know, so many even here in Wisconsin who are right above that threshold for free and reduced price meal eligibility, who certainly faced increasingly difficult circumstances throughout the pandemic in terms of what their household food budgets would look like. We can even see that if we look at food pantries and food banks and other forms of emergency food assistance and how much the demand for that really increased during the pandemic. So I think it was partly really an issue of the logistical convenience and recognizing that food service providers really had like enough going on. So if they could not have to deal with the administrative burden of really sorting students into these different categories, like that would be tremendously helpful. But also really recognizing that there are so many people who really would benefit from this from an economic standpoint, who needed that additional assistance and who I believe really still need that assistance. But one thing I did want to just mention is that when these waivers were extended in the past, they were actually extended multiple times. It was bipartisan agreement. So this was actually something that had support from both parties and Congress. So it was actually a real surprise for a lot of people in the school nutrition community that these waivers weren't extended by at least one additional year. So it's left a lot of people within the school nutrition profession who really, really care about the well-being of students and families in their communities in a really difficult position of trying to figure out how they're actually going to maintain a high quality meal service when school meals not only this summer start up those programs for those districts that offer them, but also when school resumes in the fall. So I think it's putting people in a really difficult position right now.
At a fundamental level, what is the case for schools being a provider of at least a portion of the nutrition for the students who come through their doors?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting. And the U.S. is definitely one of the countries across the world that chooses to sort students into these categories of, students whose families have a certain household income will get meals for free, others reduced price and others paid. So we create this kind of class-based system that not only sorts students based on class, but also in a lot of schools and communities really can have this unintended consequence of creating a lot of not only class, but also race-based segregation in the cafeteria in terms of who's participating in the federal school meal programs and who might be bringing meals from home or purchasing meals if the school has an off-campus like policy where students are able to leave during the lunch hour. So there are so many countries and actually a handful of states now in the United States, so California, Maine, and Vermont, that actually have free school meal for all programs and are really starting to do a lot of work to conceptualize this as a universal right. So something that students just everyone, regardless of income, should be able to participate in as part of the schooling experience. And when that happens, it's really a wonderful opportunity to start building nutrition education and other kinds of food education into the curriculum. And when you don't have a program that really is a universal program, meaning it's a program that everybody participates in, it's really difficult to do that kind of integrated food education. And you also have these huge issues surrounding people really experiencing shame and potentially really feeling like such a sense of stigma that even though they might qualify for free or reduced price meals, they don't want to participate in the program because they feel like it marks them as poor or lesser than other students. So there are tremendous issues that have been talked about really more significantly within the last 10 years around this issue of lunch shaming. And that's this particular phenomenon where school districts may have a certain amount of unpaid meal debt that a student might accrue. And once they reach a certain amount, the school nutrition department has to take some sort of action surrounding how they might actually get a household to pay that money that's owed because they ultimately have to be accountable for it in some way or another. So that has led in the past to schools sometimes having really punitive policies, but there has been a lot of advocacy efforts and some great legislation that have tried to really combat those efforts so that students aren't overtly identified if they do have an unpaid meal debt balance. But that said, students are really savvy and food is really symbolic. So, a lot of students do recognize when they're in the cafeteria with others who is eating the school lunch and who isn't. And that really can be a class marker that can be a deterrent in for participating in the school meals. So I think it's a really important thing to have not only a universal program, but a universal free school meal program. And if we think about it, you know, when somebody enters a public school, we don't charge based on family income for like a math class or an English class or literally any other aspect of the school day. So it's a little bit strange that something as necessary as food to a student's health and well-being and academic achievement would be something that we would charge for based on household income and make students feel that sense of separation from each other.
We're talking about school lunches with Jennifer Gaddis, Associate Professor of Civil Society and Community Studies at UW-Madison, author of the book The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. She's with us to talk about waivers passed by Congress through the USDA that gave access to free school lunches to all children, what it might mean if and when those waivers expire at the end of this month. I want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Do you think it sounds like it's time for these waivers to end? Why or why not? What would you like to see change in school districts when it comes to school lunch programs during the school year, during the summer? Do you have personal experiences as a parent, a student, or someone working in the schools or the lunch programs yourself that you'd like to share with us? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Jennifer Gaddis, Assistant Professor of Civil Society and Community Studies at the UW-Madison, author of the book The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. She's talking to us about the future of universal free school lunches as a program passed by Congress via the USDA, scheduled to expire unless the funding is renewed and the waivers are renewed by the end of the month. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about these waivers and how they work? Are you concerned parent or teacher or student or school lunch staffer worried about lunches this summer? If you're a teacher, what kind of need have you seen for these free or reduced school lunches amongst your students? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We've been focusing, Jennifer, on the federal level. You mentioned some states experimenting on some of these things. Some legislation was introduced in Wisconsin, I think, by Democrats, didn't pass. Are there things that a state like Wisconsin could do if these waivers and funding aren't renewed?
Yes. I'm glad you mentioned that. So that effort is actually part of a broader coalition called the Healthy School Meals for All Coalition, which is a really exciting multi-sector and multi-generational group of people working together to get free school meals permanently for students in Wisconsin. And I really encourage people to check out the webpage for that organization at healthyschoolmealsforallwisconsin.org. So there are definitely efforts at the state level, including this ongoing coalition. Outside of that, there are actually district level things that can happen. So the primary way that school districts in Wisconsin are going to still serve free school meals for all this summer, it will actually be through the regular summer meal program that will operate in the way it has historically, where any young person under the age of 18 can get a free meal if their school chooses to participate in the summer program. It's really when we go back in the fall that households will have to submit those free reduced price meal applications in order to qualify. But there is a provision called the community eligibility provision, and that will be the main way that schools continue to serve free meals. This program has grown in popularity every year in Wisconsin for the past 9 years and now covers about 468 schools and about 171,000 students across the state. And in these schools, which are primarily, I would say, like high poverty schools, both breakfast and lunch are offered to students free of charge, and schools get a single reimbursement rate back from the federal government. And it's a little bit complicated in that the reimbursement rate is higher, basically the higher the poverty level is for that particular school or district that's participating in the community eligibility program. But there are a ton of schools, hundreds in fact, that are on the edge of making this program work financially. So nearly 100,000 students across the state are actually enrolled in schools that are eligible to participate in the community eligibility provision, meaning they could provide free breakfast and lunches to all students, but those schools are not currently enrolled in the program. So what that means is that there's tremendous opportunity at the local level to try to figure out, well, how could we make that work financially? Maybe it's an additional contribution from the school board prioritizing this as an issue. Maybe it's something for local PTOs to work on or for students themselves to be working on in their own form of youth organizing. So I think that there are so many ways that we're very close to actually being able to access additional federal funding at the district level, particularly for the highest need districts in the state. So that's a really great place to start. But really, any school district can pass a resolution in support of universal school meals and work to prioritize these things. So I think this is something that we can all work on at the district level as well.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Tim is with us in Milwaukee. Tim, hi.
Hello. I'd like to comment on the quality, though, of the food that's being served in public schools. We live in Milwaukee, but my kid goes to one of the suburban school districts. That's, you know, in fairly good shape financially. And the school menus are just terrible. It is all junk food. It is things we do not serve at home. And our child, who was kind of raised to be, he's 9 years old now, raised to be aware of, you know, what he's eating and why we don't eat certain things. He looks at the menu as well, and there's pizza and macaroni and cheese and things on there. And, you know, he doesn't even, want the school lunch either. He takes it to school. It's a little bit inconvenient for us to prepare that in the morning, but we have far better healthful choices, and it's really not all that difficult to find these things to put in a bag to send to school. And we kind of wonder why the schools can't serve the same thing that we're sending him to school with.
Tim, thanks for the call. That gets to the real food part of the subtitle of your book, Jennifer.
Yeah, I appreciate Tim's question. And I would say that there's tremendous variation from school district to school district in terms of what school meals look like. So all districts that participate in federal programs have to meet a minimum nutritional set of standards. But, you know, in terms of what the actual food quality looks like, that can be quite variable. So I would say that there have been some additional challenges in particular this year. So some things that a lot of parents like Tim might like to see, like salad bars in schools, where a lot of schools might be offering more fresh produce. Those are things that a number of schools didn't really do during like the initial transition back to in-person schooling. So I think that that is something to kind of take into account, that there might be some improvements after we undergo this rough patch of sort of readjustment. But also, if you aren't happy with what school meals look like in your district, I bet that there are others who feel the same way that you do. So what I would really encourage is for people to really work together to try to improve school meals for the benefit of all. And there are some really great tools. The Chef Anne Foundation is one that I really like to point people to, because it has an advocacy toolkit that really helps parents who want to see scratch cooked meals and really healthy sort of quote unquote real food in schools understand not only the complexities of school food, but pathways for getting the kind of school meals that you might like to see in your children's schools. So I think that it's really important to be talking with others and really working on this as a collective issue, rather than just feeling like this isn't a system that we can invest in or change. I think that there are so many great examples that we can point to. In fact, in my book, I profile a number of districts that have transitioned away from like the heat and serve model of school meals to doing tremendous things with farm to school sourcing and phasing out the kinds of ingredients that might be concerning to parents that are more conscious about feeding their children like more highly processed foods. So there are a lot of great places that have invested in scratch cooking, which is also significantly better for the workers themselves, I might add. So we have so many examples from rural small school districts to suburban districts to urban districts across the country, a number of which I actually profile in my book, that point to a different pathway forward. So I think it's really just about sort of taking the energy that we have now around universal meals and around like the kind of meals we would like to see in our schools, and really working together to make those systems possible in our districts.
Just the last few moments, Jennifer, for families with children facing food insecurity, maybe this summer already, can you give us a couple quick resources?
Yes. So you can always go online, and there's also a number that you can text. I would say Feeding America is a great resource to be able to identify what those numbers and summer feeding sites are in your area. I don't know the number off the top of my head, I apologize, but you can text a number and it will give you the different sites around you where free summer meals are being offered. So oftentimes that's not only schools, but other community sites as well. So I think that that's a really important resource for the summer in particular.
Jennifer, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Jennifer Gaddis, Associate Professor of Civil Society and Community Studies at the UW-Madison, author of the book The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. She joins us to talk about what it would mean if federal waivers issuing universal free school lunches came to an end this summer. That is scheduled to expire at the end of this month without action in Congress. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, keep kids reading this summer. Kate Archer-Kent gets advice from a youth literacy expert who shares ideas plus some book recommendations. And you can join in with yours, your experiences, and books you'd like to share. That is coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. The movie Top Gun Maverick, starring Tom Cruise, just like the original Top Gun, is bringing lots of people back to the theaters with a big opening day weekend. I haven't seen it, but I just learned something about it. It is the top-grossing super vocalic movie of all time. I saw that in the tweet from the people at Beyond Wordplay, then I read a little further to find out what super vocalic meant. Super vocalic means a word or a phrase, or in this case a movie title, that has each vowel, A, E, I, O, and U, exactly once. So let's check it out. Top Gun Maverick. The O is in top, the U is in gun. Maverick brings it on home with the A, E, and I. The previous top-earning super-vocalic movie, according to Beyond Wordplay, it was Mary Poppins Returns. Added bonus, it has exactly one each of A, E, I, O, U, and Y. Can I do a super-vocalic sign-off here? News up. I, Rob. A.